Hey there, this is Tom from the future. I'm whispering because time travel requires whispering. I don't know if you've listened to the newest episodes in order to find this out, but with the holidays here, there is a brand new thing that Patreon is doing where you can gift subs, which is really cool because that means a few different things. First of all, if you know somebody else who enjoys this show, you can get them a sub to whatever tier you want for whatever amount of time. So if you look at certain rewards and you think it would be really cool to get them those rewards, or just being part of the community, or even just getting ad-free episodes, that's something you can give this holiday season. Also, it means that if you've been wanting to sign up for the Patreon and you haven't been able to, and you want to ask for it as a gift from somebody else, then that can work as well. So both of those things are options. All that you have to do is go to Patreon, log in, or create an account. You can just create a free account. You don't have to sign up with anybody, anyone's Patreon. And then you go to the Patreon page for this show and you choose to gift a thing. You go through all the little options and you send them a gift. It's really simple. It would be super helpful to us. And it's a fun thing to give. So hope you consider that, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday. All right, let's get back to the show.
Welcome to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast, the show that explores the background of Tolkien's amazing world from the very beginning. As we begin Riddles in the Dark, Chapter 5 of The Hobbit, it occurs to me that this is probably the most memorable chapter in the entire book. I would wager that if you were to get together 100 people who have read the book or even watched the movie and ask them, what do you remember about The Hobbit? I bet a majority, or at least the largest number of people, will respond about something in Chapter 5. Now, whether that's the actual riddles scene with Gollum, or Gollum himself, or finding the ring, Bilbo being lost in the dark, there's something about this chapter which feels like the gravitational center of the entire book. It is extremely memorable, and I think that that happens for a number of reasons. First of all, it's simple. In later chapters, we have the Battle of the Five Armies, and the complexity of that is enticing and very interesting, but very complex. At the beginning, we have the early stories, the different parts of the story, which I would branch off to different individual stories. So the story of Bilbo and meeting all of the dwarves in his home, and the story of the beginning of their journey and then running into the trolls, or the story about how they were wandering in the wilderness, but then Elrond helped them out. And of course, all of those are interesting in their own ways, but they are not, I don't know, as simple, maybe, as this section of the story. You have a very dark environment. You have a singular character looking for how to escape. You have an emotional context that all of us can identify with. Feeling lost, being in the dark, being afraid of what scary monsters might be lurking in the dark. The finding of a treasure or something of value. All of that resonates at a very, very deep level. And I think it feels very human. Tolkien here is taking something that we all experience. We can't say that we've all experienced welcoming in a bunch of dwarves into our home. We can say that maybe some of us have experienced having a bunch of people in our home who we don't know very well and having to be the kind of party host to that. But that's not something everybody goes through. None of us have dealt with trolls in the wild. Very few of us have wandered around in the wilderness looking for shelter. But when it comes to that feeling of being lost in the dark and afraid, even as children, this is something that we feel when it's dark out and it's nighttime and we have to go to our bedrooms. There's something intuitively human here. And then there's a twist. The monster in the dark is willing to play a game. But we're not going to get to that part until next time. First, we have to discuss Bilbo's situation and where he is before he realizes that Gollum is waiting in the darkness. So as a reminder from last time, Bilbo was knocked on the head, fell unconscious, and the party continued on without him. They did not realize that he had fallen. And although the book is generally from Bilbo's perspective, we don't have any complexities here. All we have is a hobbit waking up in the dark, a dark that was as dark as it was already with his eyes shut. He wasn't even sure when he opened his eyes that his eyes were open. And that perspective moving forward. And we have to go through the stages of this because he's dealing with this discomfort, this confusion, this fear. And yet Tolkien, as he does with the other chapters so far, has to kind of rein this in a little bit. It's something that children can identify with, but it's also something deeply scary. He even says here in the very first paragraph, "No one was anywhere near him." And this is right after he talks about how dark it was. "Just imagine his fright." And we get an exclamation mark. And I know I'm going into like English professor territory here, but Tolkien uses exclamation marks generally more often than a lot of authors do. And I think part of that is to build excitement and anticipation or fear, especially because this was originally intended for a younger audience, but a general audience still at the same time. But it is interesting that he uses exclamation marks as much as he does. Just imagine his fright. He's trying to get you to put yourself in Bilbo's shoes here. He could hear nothing, see nothing, and he could feel nothing except the stone on the floor. He's already painting this picture of what it must have been like to be, well, Bilbo doesn't wear shoes, but in Bilbo's hairy feet. Slowly he got up, and I think this is another interesting moment. He doesn't use a word like rose. He uses a phrase, "he got up," which feels very colloquial, if that's how you say that word. It feels he got up. Generally, from what I've experienced, people who tend to be English scholars don't really like the word "got" very much because it is not very precise, but yet it is very common. And I think that we're looking at language here that, again, allows us to see this through the eyes of a common person. He got up and groped about on all fours till he touched the wall of the tunnel. Now, this makes a lot of sense. If you were completely in the dark in an underground cave, you wouldn't know where there is a precipice, where there are rocks that you could trip over. It would be very, very difficult to walk without being able to see. But he doesn't find anything. No goblins, no signs of dwarves. And we learn that his head is swimming. He's still coming out of this stupor because he was smacked in the head. You know that feeling when you've slept too long and you have a hard time waking up because not because you're sleepy still, but because your mind is foggy because you slept too long. Or if you've actually suffered a concussion before, that feeling of just kind of coming back around to awareness, making your brain work again, that's where he's at here. And again, I think this is something that many of us, most of us, can identify with. And he's confused, which is interesting because we find out later that because hobbits typically dwell underground, even though their homes aren't necessarily cavernous and cave-like, they're more comfortable than that, they generally have a good sense of direction in the dark and underground. And this is another thing that I find very interesting. This is something that dawned on me when reading through this section of the book again, is how much of this book is underground. We start underground. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. We end up in the most dangerous places underground, in this area here with the goblins and, of course, Gollum under the mountains. And then we end up in a singular mountain underground with a dragon. It's no wonder that fantasy adventure games after this imagined dungeons and reworked the word dungeon from being like the place that you throw prisoners or torture people to a cavernous underground area where adventure lies. That definition shifted. And it's no wonder. They were reading The Hobbit. Oh, and The Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of underground there too. So he crawls around for a bit. And then we get this. His hand met what felt like a tiny ring of cold metal lying on the floor of the tunnel. And what's interesting is the narrator doesn't say it's definitely a ring. It felt like a ring. So we're not 100% sure what it is yet, but it feels like a metal ring. And then we get this line. It was a turning point in his career, but he did not know it yet. Now, this is interesting to me for two reasons. First of all, it's foreshadowing, right? This thing that feels like a tiny ring on the floor is somehow going to be a turning point in his career, which makes no sense because we don't understand even what it is or the context of what it can do. But Bilbo didn't know it yet either. So we don't understand, and Bilbo doesn't understand. Again, we are being put in Bilbo's, I guess I still can't say shoes, furry feet. And then he has this automatic response to just put it in his pocket without even thinking, is what it says here. And that I also find interesting because was this a reflex? Was this a natural reaction when you just pick something up that you need to carry with you that you just kind of stick it in your pocket and you don't even think about it, which is, again, something we can all identify with. Or in hindsight, if you know the book, if you know the stories, you know what this ring is. Was that the one ring already influencing Bilbo's actions? And he had no concept of that yet. It could be both. I have to wonder what Tolkien's initial thoughts were on this, because originally it wasn't the One Ring. It was just a magical ring that could turn you invisible. That's all it was. And then later on, when he was writing The Lord of the Rings, it developed. It became more and more. And he went back and edited The Hobbit. So I have to imagine initially this would have just been a reflex, but upon reanalyzing the book, it works in two different ways. And so he decides, well, the ring's really not of any use, and he gets tired of just kind of crawling around. So he sits down on the floor, and it says he gave himself up to complete miserableness for a long while. He thought of himself frying bacon and eggs in his own kitchen at home, for he could feel inside that it was high time for some meal or other, and that only made him miserabler. So a few things here. Miserableness, wonderful word. I mean, it's a terrible thing to feel, but we all understand what that feels like, to feel miserable. And then at the end of this sentence, miserabler is not a real word. In fact, when I try to type this in my notes, it autocorrects because it doesn't think that's a real word. And this is another one of those signs of Tolkien understanding how language works and being willing to just create a new word on the spot because it makes sense for the moment. I think it also gives us this perspective because we always have to remember that these books were written by characters. This was written down by Bilbo. Bilbo would be the kind of person also to make up a word like miserabler. So it works on multiple levels. So the next paragraph explains how he's trying to figure out what's going on. He can't figure out why he was left behind, what was going on, why his head is so sore. He's confused. He's scared. He's in the dark. And he realizes that it must have been for a long while. Long enough that he's now hungry and there's nobody nearby. They must have left him here. And then he searches for more comfort. Now, remember, there's a part of him that's been seeking the comforts of home, this bacon and eggs, Baggins part of him. And it makes sense here that in this moment, he decides, okay, he's going to look for the little bit of comfort that he still has in this moment. He searches for his pipe and he realizes it wasn't broken. And I love this little note here. And that was something. Okay, so we have this beginning of this hopefulness. He's rising out of the misery. That was something. Okay, at least the pipe wasn't broken. He's thankful for that. And he felt in his pouch, and there was still tobacco.
and that was something more, this rising action. And then he looked for the matches, and that shattered his hopes completely. We get this rising, and then this falling. But then we are told that that might actually be a good thing. Just as well for him as he agreed when he came to his senses. Goodness knows what the striking of matches and the smell of tobacco would have brought on him out of a dark hole in that horrible place. Still at the moment, he felt very crushed. And again, this is another one of those things that we all know what it feels like. That feeling of, well, rationally I understand that that's probably a good thing, but it still feels bad. But that rising and falling situation, finding the pipe, the tobacco, learning that he doesn't have any matches left, creates this kind of, I guess you could say, we're traveling from one situation to the next, from one thing to the next, and it's pushing the story forward. He's in the dark, he's miserable, he tries to solve the miserableness, he can't really do that, but then he realizes that there's something else here. Oh yeah, he has this dagger. And he'd kind of forgotten about it, which is convenient. And it's also convenient that it tells us here that he wore it inside his breeches. Now, breeches is not a word that we use commonly very much anymore. It means basically a style of pants that would fasten around above your ankles. And they tended to be pretty roomy. You see them still on people who do things like ride horses, things like that. They are a style that is of a time. And yet there's a lot of room in there. And why he would have stored them in his breeches rather than on the outside of his pants, which would be easier to grab in a moment where he would need it, we don't get an explanation for that. But it does help explain why the goblins didn't take it, because they did not know it was there. And so he draws it out, and we're now moving from one thing to the next. And for the first time, Bilbo realizes that this blade also glows. It shone pale and dim before his eyes. So it is an elvish blade too, he thought. And goblins are not very near, and yet not far enough. So the goblins must have still been around, and it kind of raises the question, how close do the goblins have to be for the glowing to begin? But also, he was in a completely dark environment. You know that thing that happens when you go to bed, or you're somewhere where it's very, very dark and you go to get your cell phone out. And even though the cell phone has adjusted to the low light level, it still looks really bright because it's on like 20% brightness. But even that's too high. So you drop it to like 10%. And that's still too high. And you drop it to like 5%. And you can tell that like the phone's not usually supposed to operate at that low level of light. But that's kind of how dim it needs to be for it to look normal to you in that darkness. I feel like that's a very long explanation for kind of what's going on here with this dagger, is that even a slight tiny bit of glow is enough to illuminate the cave around him so that he can at least begin to see some. And speaking of the cave around him, that's something that we're going to discuss on the Patreon episode, the bonus episode for this week. So if that's something you're interested in. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to move that middle section to the end of the episode from now on. It's been in the middle for a while. I've played with other shows that I do with putting it at the end. People felt like it cut the episode short, but it's still the same amount of time. So I'd rather it just not get in the way of the narration. So we're going to put that at the end of the story. I'll thank all the patrons and do the reading of the reviews and stuff like that at the end of the episode. There might still be a mid break where like ads show up, but that's just kind of par for the course. I do this for a living. So if you don't want ads, join the Patreon. I would appreciate it. But here, let's continue with the story. He draws the blade out, realizes that it is glowing, and somehow was comforted by that. And I think this is probably for a few reasons, not just because it was shining light on the situation and he had not been able to see yet, but also because it gave him some agency, some safety. He has a blade, and it's not just any blade. This is an elven blade. This is the best weapon that he could have alone in the dark among goblins. So for the first time, his fear is removed, or at least some amount of fear is removed. And then he thinks, go back? No good at all. Go sideways? Impossible. Go forward? Only thing to do, on we go. And I've noted here that this is one of those humorous moments. We get exclamation marks. Impossible. Go sideways? What does sideways even mean? I guess down a side passage, but it's a little bit silly, right? We're kind of into the silly range. And at the end of this little paragraph, we also have him feeling along the wall and his heart goes pitter and a patter. Again, that rhyming, the sing-songy kind of poetic thing that Tolkien tends to do with Bilbo here. But I think that's indicative of Bilbo's personality. There's something childlike in the way that he describes things sometimes. He's a little bit silly, even when writing about a moment like this. Now, the very next paragraph we get, now certainly Bilbo is in what is called a tight place. And I love the use of tight place here. This is something Tolkien does where he takes something and it has multiple meanings, sometimes three meanings or four meanings. In this situation, I think there's two meanings here. Physically, this is a tight place, right? He's in a cave underground, but also it's a tight place, meaning a difficult situation. But you must remember, it was not quite so tight for him as it would have been for me or for you. So he takes that expression, tight place, which we would assume means difficult situation, and then he starts making it physical. He explains that whole thing here about how hobbits can find their way underground better than you or me, and that they do not easily lose their sense of direction underground, which leads me to believe that by this point, he's starting to figure out which way forward is, because that's what his thoughts are telling him. It's time to move forward, not back, not sideways. And so he must have been able to distinguish at this point which way forward was, even though forward seems to lead down, which we'll get to in a minute. Then we get this. They have a fund of wisdom and wise sayings that men have mostly never heard or have forgotten long ago. This implies two things. First of all, the value of knowledge that is passed on through wise sayings and just kind of common sense. The common sense world of the things you grow up hearing. I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now, but the kinds of sayings that mean that, hey, this is like generational knowledge that just gets passed down, and it's something all of our children should know and their children should know. And so we make songs about it. We say rhymes about it. We all use the same phrase when the same thing happens, that sort of thing. But also that men have mostly never heard or have forgotten long ago implies that at some point, the culture of hobbits combines with the culture of men. This ties into some answers that Tolkien has given in interviews and I think some of the, if I remember correctly, some of the extra content, including the appendices, that explain that hobbits and men eventually kind of blended back together. They're still mannish. They were always mannish. They're not dwarves. They're not elves. They're much more mannish than anything else. Hobbits, that is. But eventually they kind of worked their way into the mannish population and they became just a whole group. And that those sayings eventually went away when inundated with the sheer numbers of the mannish culture, which were much bigger than the hobbit culture. At least that's what I would assume from this statement. And then we get this line, which is interesting because the narrator is speaking here and we know Bilbo writes the book and yet is also pretending not to be the narrator. It's kind of the tone of this. I should not have liked to have been in Mr. Baggins' place all the same. It shows that the narrator, whether intended by Bilbo when writing this or redacted later by maybe a separate source, is a distinct different personality. Or it just doubles down on the fact that Bilbo just didn't want to be there. Which makes sense. The tunnel seemed to have no end. All he knew was that it was still going down pretty steadily. Now, he keeps in this direction and he follows the twists and turns. He hurries past these openings and side passages, which are smaller. He kind of has a sense that this is the main path. And yet it continues heading down, which would mean two things. It's getting further from Goblin Town because they descended from there. So this is where the path continues. But it also is going deeper into the mountain, which doesn't seem to be a good way to get out of the mountain. And yet he continues on. And we get these little moments. He hurried past for fear of goblins or half-imagined dark things coming out of them, these side passages, which is exactly what you do when you're a little kid and you have to go to bed and you have to walk past like the dark bathroom or some other room on the way to your bedroom. And you're just like, everybody does this, right? Everybody does this when you're a kid. I think this is one of those things that's just baked into us as human beings. This whole like, I'm going to go quickly into this room because who knows what's in there? And there's never anything in there, but it's just instinct, right? And so he continues on, and we get this. I do not know how long he kept on like this, hating to go on, not daring to stop. He doesn't know what to do. He's afraid, and he's getting tireder than tired. We get this repetition again. Tireder, a new word, than tired. It's a slight alleviation of the darkness of what we're dealing with here. And again, time is just kind of hard to track here underground. It seems like it was all the way to tomorrow and over it to the days beyond. It feels like he's just walking forever. And then he trotted splash into water, ! Ugh, ! More exclamation marks. I think that these are here for humorous reasons. Like, oh, you know what that's like, stepping in a puddle when you didn't expect it and it's cold, that sort of thing. And then he stops because he's trying to figure out, is this an underground river? Is this a little puddle? Is this a lake? How dangerous is this? And he could hear, when he listened, drops drip, drip, dripping. Again, the repetition, it's making it cute and kind of funny so that we don't get too scared. From an unseen roof into the water below, but there seemed no other sort of sound. We're reminded that it's not just dark, it is silent. Sensory deprivation is terrible for humans. There's a reason why this is something that some prisons will use for the worst criminals when they act up. A place that is silent, dark, alone, is something that we just do not know how to deal with. And just like everything else in this section, we move from one setting, one set of things to discuss, to the next. We get this forward motion. And we learn that this is a pool or a lake, not an underground river. He starts to figure this out. Again, he's familiar with underground areas, and he knows not to wade out into the darkness, first of all, because he could not swim, which is interesting. Now, I've noted this for a few reasons. First of all, we know that Bilbo's parents died in a boating accident because they could not swim on the Brandywine River. So he has that fear built in. That's how he lost his parents. Secondly, I did some research about this. In the early 1900s in the UK, it was rather uncommon and just beginning to be a thing to have public swimming pools and swimming lessons for regular people. Now, if you've lived in the UK, you know, you don't really go swimming in the ocean very much. I mean, I'm sure some people do, but the waters are cold and dark, and often the coastlines are not necessarily the best beaches in the world. It's not known for its beaches, but also it's cold. The water is cold. It's very far north. And so many people in the UK today can swim. It's been something that they've taken care of, but you go back 100 years and this was not a common thing. So it would be normal to assume that somebody may not be able to swim. Whereas today it's much more common to just be able to swim. But then we're told that it's not just the swimming that's the problem. It's what's in the water. Nasty, slimy things with big, bulging, blind eyes and wriggling in the water. Notice the alliteration here. Nasty, slimy things with big, bulging, blind eyes wriggling in the water. The B's and the W's. This is, again, supposed to be poetic, or at least slightly humorous when talking about something very scary. There's strange things living in the pools and the hearts of mountains, in the lakes, in the hearts of mountains. Fish whose fathers swam in, goodness only knows how many years ago, and never swam out again, while their eyes grew bigger and bigger and bigger from trying to see in the blackness. This is doing two things. It's explaining the past, the dark, terrible creatures of the world, the unspoken things that live under the earth, which we learn about more in the Lord of the Rings for sure. But then it's also foreshadowing something that he's about to come across. It also says there are other things more slimy than fish. And I think that this is another one of those moments where Tolkien is using double meaning. Sure, things can physically be slimy. A wet fish can feel slimy. But you would also describe somebody who is manipulative or untrustworthy as being slimy. Even in the tunnels and caves the goblins have made for themselves, there are other things living unbeknown to them that have sneaked in from outside to lie up in the dark. Now, this implies that maybe it wasn't just things in the very far distant past that snuck in to live in the dark places, but things that may have shown up more recently. Interesting. And then we're told about those dark things being the original owners of these caves, and it was only later that the goblins connected up the passages and made this a place for them to live, which we'll talk about in the bonus episode this week. It's actually pretty interesting. And then we get this. Deep down here by the dark water lived old Gollum, a small, slimy creature. I don't know where he came from, nor who or what he was. He was Gollum. As dark as darkness, except for two big round, pale eyes in his thin face. All right, thank you for tuning in to today's episode. We're doing this at the end of the episode now instead of the middle. I feel like that's a little bit more convenient for people. We'll try it out, and if people hate it, we'll put it back in the middle. We'll get into Gollum next week. I'm excited to talk about Gollum finally, and now's our opportunity to thank everybody who supports the show. Thank you so much to our new patrons, Taylor B., Dominic, Colton B., Jay Willie, and Nico. Welcome to the Patreon. I hope you're enjoying your ad-free episodes or your bonus episodes if you signed up for that, or heck, getting up there for the VIP status and getting your t-shirts and all those other things. And speaking of VIPs, I have to shout out our entire list of VIPs. AK Music Lover, Apollo, Atlee Morton, Azel Razel, Barney D, Bo, Brandy D, Christopher E, oh, I already messed up, Courtney S, Cutter Metalworks, Daniel Nightweaver, David S, David M, Divine Madman, Fulcrum, George B, Gerald CFC, Gimli A Break, Jay Willie, Gemma D, Jezzer, Katie S, Capenna, Lori B, Mason Weathertop, Nick K, Nostrils of Sauron, Richard J, Rivqua, Rosie Rose, Saruman the Stinky, TJT, and Tour Son of Hur. Thank you so much to all of you. And of course, you know, I couldn't do this without you, so I really do appreciate it. Also, just a reminder that Patreon updated how they can do things now. You can gift subscriptions to people, which means if there's somebody that you know would enjoy the show or already listens to the show but would love being able to access, say, ad-free episodes or bonus episodes, any of that stuff, you can gift that. You just have to log into your account, and then there's a whole section. You choose the thing, gift the thing. It's pretty obvious. You'll know how to do it. Also, it means that if you are interested in getting a subscription for yourself, you could recommend to someone else in your life that they gift you a subscription, and then you would be able to access all that awesome stuff and help support the show. So I think that's a really cool feature, and I hope people take advantage of it. All right, and to end this episode, we have one new review. This comes from Skebble94 in the Netherlands, who simply writes, "Perfect, 5 stars. It's just perfect. No words needed." Well, thank you so much, Skebble. That's awesome. I appreciate you taking the time to leave a review. I've also had people say things like, "I listen, I'm on an Android device. I can't really leave a review because I don't have an Apple phone." If you want to do that, the way to do it, at least that I'm aware of, is to download iTunes onto your PC or laptop or whatever, and then just make an account, go to the feed, just look it up, and then leave a review like that. It's a few extra steps. It's kind of annoying, absolutely. But if you took the time to do that, I would appreciate it, and I'll read out your words. So thanks again for being here, And I look forward to chatting with those of you who are joining me for the bonus episode this week, because we're talking about the Goblin Caves, Goblin Town, and Gollum's Cave, and what's going on with that? When did the goblins actually move in, and how has this been represented differently in different media? So I'll see you over there. Otherwise, have a great week. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast. If you'd like to learn more about other fantasy worlds, check out my other podcasts, The Elder Scrolls Lorecast, The Witcher Lorecast, and more at robotsradio.net. If you'd like to reach out, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a note on Twitter at robots_radio, or join our amazing community on the Robots Radio Discord. There are links in the show notes, or just search Robots Radio Discord, or find the link on robotsradio.net. I'll see you next time.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.
Hey there, this is Tom from the future. I'm whispering because time travel requires whispering. I don't know if you've listened to the newest episodes in order to find this out, but with the holidays here, there is a brand new thing that Patreon is doing where you can gift subs, which is really cool because that means a few different things. First of all, if you know somebody else who enjoys this show, you can get them a sub to whatever tier you want for whatever amount of time. So if you look at certain rewards and you think it would be really cool to get them those rewards, or just being part of the community, or even just getting ad-free episodes, that's something you can give this holiday season. Also, it means that if you've been wanting to sign up for the Patreon and you haven't been able to, and you want to ask for it as a gift from somebody else, then that can work as well. So both of those things are options. All that you have to do is go to Patreon, log in, or create an account. You can just create a free account. You don't have to sign up with anybody, anyone's Patreon. And then you go to the Patreon page for this show, and you choose to gift a thing. You go through all the little options, and you send them a gift. It's really simple. It would be super helpful to us, and it's a fun thing to give. So hope you consider that, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday. All right, let's get back to the show.